Hey, Andrew, here's a quick sidebar before jumping in. We recorded this episode, Bill and I, and then almost immediately after the news dropped that the tariffs were going into effect on China, Canada, and Mexico. So first and foremost, for everyone out there listening, this impacts so many people, almost everyone in our community, in our, you know, in our listenership, in the e-commerce world. So thinking of you, I'm hopeful that these are temporary and either get lifted or partially lifted in the near future. So love and support sent your way. And secondly, that is why we don't mention that in this episode. Going to be looking at our recording to publishing schedule to try to get things out quicker. If you're wondering why are they completely tone deaf and not mentioning the story, that is why. We do have a pretty deep thread in the forums if you're a community member talking about this. A lot of people sharing thoughts, opinions, strategies. So make sure to check that out if you're in the forums. And we'll be talking about it, of course, in future episodes. So thinking of you, and let's go ahead and jump into today's episode. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping 7- and 8-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And if you've been listening the last 2 or 3 weeks, you know, changing things up a little bit. And one of the things I'm very excited about is getting one of my all-time favorite people, not even to mention favorite entrepreneurs, on the show regularly with me. And that is Bill D'Alessandro. He is the CEO of Natural Dog Company. He is a business consultant. That's not even the right word, because consultant sounds so blah, but he's someone who can help in the trenches e-commerce owners really take their success and their financial stack to the next level. And you can learn more about that at BillDA.com. And also one of the co-hosts at Acquisitions Anonymous, the web's leading podcast about buying and selling, you know, e-commerce companies and just small business in general. So, and just someone I love bantering and talking shop with. So Bill, thank you for being willing to come on, and also come on, you know, the world has plans and doesn't always work out, but hopefully on a quasi-regular monthly basis here to just, you know, chew the fat, talk shop, and have fun.
Thanks, man. I'm so pumped to be on ECF as always. And if you're listening, I've had many people call me, oh, you co-host that ECF podcast. And I say, no, that's just Andrew's podcast. You know, he has me on a few times, but now I have a recurring slot. So now I can say, yes, I do sometimes co-host the ECF podcast.
You do, man. You can get some impressive podcast street cred here. I got to ask though, before we get into the nitty gritty of things, you just got back from skiing, right? Like you have 3 kids under 5. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell me how you went skiing for an extended period of time with 3 kids under 5, because this is something I was not able to hack in any kind of meaningful shape when I was in your situation.
Well, like you, I have a wonderful wife who was willing to watch the kids, and my parents live in town, which also helps. And I just kind of cashed in some chits, you know, like I work pretty hard and, you know, I do help a lot when I'm not traveling. And I said, so our mutual friend, Kelsey Larrick, invited me to go skiing in Colorado in Steamboat. And I said, honey, I'd really like to go. And she graciously agreed to let me go and then promptly came down with the flu the day after I left, which was just brutal. So she had 3 kids by herself with the flu. She got some babysitting help and some help from my parents, but she was wonderful. Let me go.
Dude, and how was it? Good snow out in Colorado?
Great snow. It was freezing. There was a cold snap. It was 20 below. And the skiing was great. But the most fun thing we did is we went to this outdoor hot springs, the Strawberry Hot Springs outside of Steamboat Springs, when it was 20 below. So you can imagine like dropping down to your bathing suit, like sprinting across the ice and getting in the hot springs while your hair is freezing as you sit there into like an ice helmet. It was crazy.
That's amazing. I mean, it's like hot springs and cold plunge, but actual cold plunge not required. You just get out and stand around for about 10 seconds.
Well, there's a river that goes by it, and some of the guys jumped in the river, which was only not solid ice because it was directly next to the warm hot tub and it was moving. So the river was like 36 degrees or something, and people That's were insane. Jumping it crazy. The cold plunge people, y'all are nuts. I don't know how you do it.
Oh, man. The skiing thing is funny because our kids are 7 to 12. And this last season, I think, was the first season where we were able to ski without me like skiing backward, hunched over, like, you know, taking about 20 years off my life. I tell anyone that, I tell kids, I'm like, the thing that I have done the most, has shown the most love for you, is teach you all how to ski. Because if you've ever done it with kids, it is an insane lift to do. So it's really fun this year being in Montana, actually getting to ski with them and seeing them start to develop, and one of them just turning into a little ripper. It's super fun. So glad you had fun at Steamboat, man, but it'll be fun when you get your kids out and through that lift too.
I've been told that there are people you can hire, like a school for skiing, that will teach your kids to ski. Have you never heard about that?
No, they're all communists. They indoctrinate your kids. You know, terrible people, 100% of them.
So, that seems like what I'm going to do. Like, here you go, ski school.
So I am, yes. And I am 100% for doing that in some cases. But I'm probably going to come across as a cheapskate here. But if you have three kids, you know how much a ski lesson is? Like one ski lesson, like they take them out for 2 hours, like $180 plus tip. So you get three kids out there. Anyway, yes, we could have done that. But it as much as I gripe about it, it is also fun taking them out, being with them and getting them to do it. But we probably could have dropped a little coin and, you know, maybe done a little, had a few days where we could have got out on our own. But yeah, I think there's a good middle ground.
Yeah. The way my dad did it is we always went to ski school in the morning and then skied with them, my parents, in the afternoon.
Interesting.
So you kind of got best of both. And I think they got to ski the good powder in the morning without us. And then in the afternoon when they were tired anyway, they just cruised greens with us.
That's a good way. The way my parents did it was they just said, oh, you're in sixth grade. Why don't you go on the school ski trip and teach yourself to ski? And immediately after day one, no, not even day one, like hour one, I took the highest lift to the top of the mountain and proceeded to have the most terrifying descent of my entire life. And that's how I learned how to ski. So
that's how you learn in the deep end.
In the deep end. Well, Bill, let's jump in, man. So kind of the rough idea of this new format is we're going to talk about some of the interesting forum discussions from the last month in the e-commerce field community, which is our community for vetted 7 and 8 figure members and store owners. And we're going to have some discretion here. We're going to keep it somewhat high level. Obviously, there's a level of confidentiality. I want to be respectful of that. But just kind of touch on some of the interesting discussions. And then also just some of the interesting news stories and things that we've come across our desk, as well as just interesting life things. Like we just, you know, spent the last 6 minutes talking about life, kids, and skiing. So first one I want to throw out there for us, Bill, to kind of talk about, and a big shout out to Sonia. I'll leave her last name off just because, again, confidentiality. But if you're in the forums, you know who she is, for starting both of these awesome discussions. She's been dropping some just absolutely epic stuff in the forum. So Sonia, thank you. Need to get you on the podcast here if you're up for it in the near future and talk about stuff. But she started a great discussion talking about offshore marketing teams, pay ranges, and specifically teams in Latin America. So Bill, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about, I know you've leveraged a Latin American team for a couple of years now. I've kind of dipped my toes into that recently and I'm looking to hire more there. So I was curious, maybe you can jump in here first. Are you still using that team? Is it still working well? And if you're willing, I mean, we won't name out individual contributors and salaries, but kind of rough pay scales for what you're paying for different types of roles.
Yeah. So I would say that the Latin American outsourcing market is the set of countries that really unlocked outsourcing for me, because kind of pre-COVID, I tried the folks in the Philippines. I tried kind of Asia. And I just had repeated bad experiences. I had a couple of good experiences like in Ukraine for software developers, et cetera, but I just struggled in Asia. And then I had my co-host on Acquisitions Anonymous, Michael Girdley, said, you really should try Latin America. And he talked me into it. And the big benefits of Latin America are time zone is the same. So they're on when you're on. So they basically can feel like your coworkers, like you can get on Zoom with them. Because they're awake when you're awake and you're not asking them to work weird hours overnight. They also have a very different culture, I've found. Their culture is more similar to ours. It's not the same, right? There are some differences, but more similar than Asian cultures. One of the things that I always struggled with Asian cultures is they can really avoid confrontation. So like if they don't understand a thing, they'll just kind of like bumble through it for a week until like you catch it and it's wrong and you go, if you didn't understand, why didn't you tell me? You know, or like they'll never tell you they're wrong. Like they're very deferential or can be very deferential. Whereas the Latin American culture does not have that. I mean, in fact, they can be fiery and will definitely push back, which I like. I mean, if they don't get it, they will tell you. If they have opinion, they will share it. I really like that for my work style. They also, in my experience, have a little bit more of a shared culture. Like their brands are a little bit more similar to our brands. They are taking in more American culture than the folks in Asia. So if you're trying to do marketing or graphic design, you know, a graphic design for brands in Asia looks very different than graphic designs in America, right? But graphic designs in South America are not as different. So they just kind of, it translates a little better.
The role I'm looking to hire for next in Latin America is a director of marketing is too strong because it's not someone who is going to be kind of overseeing a whole ton of people, but one or two key people that could be the key, my key right-hand man or woman for all things marketing, for paid ads, for, you know, analytics, attribution, like all of these little things, you know, A-B split testing things, testing copy, working with a creative, someone like that who was not entry level, but had a fairly versatile and was definitely, you know, out of 0 out of 10 from a seniority level, it's, you know, say a 7 or an 8. So do you have someone like that? And if so, like roughly, what's been your best way of finding them? Do you still use Hire with Near? I know that's, I think that's Michael's company or he's involved somehow, but what's, or are you going the old fashioned way still in hiring people on, you know, LinkedIn, Latin America or whatever the option is?
So I have I've used all of the different placement agencies. I've used Hired with Near. I've used Support Shepherd, Now Somewhere. I've used another one called Virtustant and probably one or two more. I've found them to be roughly interchangeable. I have also found them to be way easier than trying to hire on Indeed locally in these countries. I've tried the hire direct route, which you can do. And I know our mutual friend Maytab is really big on just hiring directly and not paying the placement fees or not paying the spread in salary. I find it to be worth it. Because, you know, you can pay 20% of their annual salary, which ends up being a relatively low number because they're not making a ton of money. But if you hire direct, you've got to post it in all the different countries. You've got to deal with all the people who post in, or apply in Spanish. Even if they do speak English, you got to be like, hey, we need you to speak English, and they'll switch. But still, it's just a lot of work to parse through all of it. So I have found value in using agencies.
Interesting. One of the things I think on the pay front, because I think, again, going back to Sonia's post, she has so many interesting things. She kind of went through and detailed all the different people that she had and what they were paying for. And effectively, she had, a 5 or 6 person marketing team on the analytical side, the creative side as well, for $100,000-ish per year, which is phenomenal. And I think one thing from a compensation that's really, obviously, you're looking to, you know, if you're hiring overseas, one of the big reasons you're doing that versus local is the cost savings, right?
Why else would you do it if you weren't going to save money? If you were not going to save any money, you would just hire domestically.
Right. And one of the things that I think is apart from just the cost savings, it allows you to do, when I look at our international team members, we overpay by probably anywhere between 75% over median to maybe 200% over kind of median salaries. And I think the things that are awesome about that is one, you know, you're helping someone create an amazing quality of life. And two, you can invest in this person. And if you treat them well, they can be around with you for decades. Like I have one woman I met in the Philippines this year, amazing team member. She's been with me for 16 years, right? Like, and the amount of institutional knowledge that you can build up with people over when you don't have to replace them is mind boggling. Anyway, so I love that. I think that's a kind of an underrated part of international hiring, which is cool.
Yeah. You asked me to talk about price ranges generally. My experience is that if you're going to hire in Asia, you're going to spend about 1/5 to 1/4 of what you would spend in America. If you hire in Latin America, what I'll call south of America, because I want to include Mexico and Dominican Republic and all these other places. If you hire south of America, you will spend between 1/4 and 1/3 of what you would spend in America. So it's more expensive for sure. But I think it is absolutely worth it because the other thing you get is you get centralized language. So even if, you know, we hire for fluent English anyway, but let's be honest, they all also speak Spanish. So they're speaking Spanish to each other, you know, which increases their efficiency. But we are just a bilingual company. Like we're English and then some people speak Spanish to each other. But if you're doing this in Asia, some people speak Cantonese, some people speak Thai, some, you know, and so that you don't end up, English is your only shared language. So you end up with a more fractured lingual situation inside your company. So, but we can hire in Mexico, you know, or in Colombia and they can understand each other.
We're doing our first big team retreat in a while this May, and we're actually hosting it in Mexico City because the woman who works with us and is organizing it lives in Mexico City. She's going to put it together. She's going to be, you know, show us around. So super excited awesome. To go, one, meet her, but also be able to have a good time with the team in Mexico City.
Yeah, we did our most recent one in Miami because it was easy for all the South Americans to fly to. Which was also great. They had a blast. We had a blast. It was really fun. But I want to do it in Mexico or in Colombia next time.
Yeah, it'd be fun. We'll have to, maybe next time we'll talk a little bit about team retreats, meetings, how those will go and how you think about structuring those. Next topic, DeepSeek. So this is, we're recording this Friday, January 31st. So it's probably a week and a half outdated by the time it airs, which in AI world is like, you know, even faster than dog years. But have you tried it much yet? Obviously, I think most people are familiar. This model that came out of China, trained for, I don't know, $6 or $7 million versus the insane amounts that the US Western AI companies are using. And I think they've used some, I think the term is distillation, where they used outputs from the big, you know, OpenAI, Gemini models to train their model, which is how they were able to do it so cost effectively. But still pretty interesting. Have you played around with that at all, Bill?
I won't put that on my phone. There's no, same reason I don't have TikTok on my phone. I'm not putting that DeepSeek app on my phone. I'm sure you've seen all of the different videos, or it won't talk about Tiananmen Square. It won't talk about the Chinese government. It won't, there's a whole bunch of stuff it won't talk about. So like, I don't need that on my phone. That being said, I think the safe way to play with it is you can download it and run it locally. You can download the weights and run it locally without having their whole app wrapper on it. But I haven't tried it personally, but apparently it is competitive with some of the lighter models from the big AI labs. And the big shockwave is it only costs, they claim, $6 million to train. I also read an article this morning that suggests they spent $1 billion on the cluster that they used to train it. So I think you got to take the $6 million number with a little bit of a grain of salt. What the big innovation, as I understand it, for DeepSeek is they did it without any human feedback. So they had a bigger model called R1, which they used to train the DeepSeek model that they got that was released. Normally the big AI labs in the States do train these models with human feedback to dial them in. The DeepSeek people did it with no human feedback, which basically means this is AI making AI better without human intervention, which starts to sound a lot like AI takeoff, which is what people at, you know, all the futurists talk about.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I had the same hesitation because I went to the website and I didn't download it on the app, but when I was creating an account, it's like you can either sign up with Google or an email address and like log in with Google. And granted, even if you logged in with Google, it probably asks you, what do you want to pass along? It's probably using it only as an authentication method. But even so, I was hesitant to use Google to log in just in case there was some crossover or they saw stuff. I also had some similar hesitations just from a privacy or a security standpoint, kind of a la TikTok and that kind of stuff. But if you download it to your own computer, granted, yes, you're not giving them access to your mobile phone, a location and things like that. But I mean, couldn't you make the argument that that software and that environment could just as easily find things on your desktop as it would on your phone?
I am not very well versed in this, but my understanding is that the part you can download is open source. It's the same way you can run it in Meta's Llama engine, just like you can run anything else. So it's, I mean, still, like, you don't know what was in those weights. You don't know if it's going to subtly respond with misinformation. You don't know if you can trust what the outputs are. But I think it is considered very unlikely that there's an embedded virus. The problem with the app, though, is that they have to wrap it in an app. And so you don't know what code is in the app wrapper, right? That could be pulling your location or whatever.
Got it. This is a little bit off, slight rabbit trail, but I got to throw it out because it's the same side. I mean, it's January 31st. Does it boggle your mind that TikTok is still operating right now in the United States?
It's like, insane to me because it's illegal. It is straight up illegal to be operating, and the current administration is simply not enforcing the law.
It is just insane. The switch, again, and not getting too much into politics, but just what you would have thought would have happened a year ago with given Trump's rhetoric about TikTok and the fact that we now had more or less, we had a law that shut them down, that is shutting them down technically. Anyway, it just blows my mind. And while I think about some of our good friends that do use TikTok as a meaningful way of the business, and it's a lifeline for them, and they've just brilliantly been able to leverage it for e-commerce success, I think from a societal good, from a national security good, it's a no-brainer to either kill it or have it be in US hands. And it boggles my mind that it's the decision was made to keep it public. It's crazy.
I think it's insane. I will say that I don't think there is any way that it should be live in the United States at all, even if it is quote unquote US owned. Because I mean, I have run businesses, much smaller businesses than TikTok, with, you know, 30 to 60 employees. I can only imagine, like, let's say suddenly, you know, Oracle owns TikTok tomorrow. There's a ton of employees at TikTok who are all probably compromised, right? There's also probably, the code is probably riddled with backdoors. I mean, there is just no way you can credibly take something that complicated and big that is totally compromised to the core and be like, oh, the Oracle owns the equity now. It's fine. Right? I just don't see any way that this should be, I mean, allowed. It's a spy app for sure. 100%.
Hey, it's Andrew here. The quick sidebar to introduce you to Tal from popsmith.com. He's one of the owners over there where they create the absolute coolest, most delicious popcorn popper I've ever seen. I love it. Our kids love it. And Tal is an OG. He's been in the community for 10 years, instrumental in being getting it going and off the ground and leading a number of meetups in California, and just a fantastic guy. And here's a snapshot of his experience with the community over the years with e-commerce fuel, our community for 7 and 8-figure store owners.
I would say the one thing that is most valuable about the ECF community is the ECF live events. I never miss them. I only had one miss because there was a last minute change in the schedule. But going to the live events, there's just so much value in not just the speakers, but more importantly, just connecting with other members in real time, in real life. Just no replacing human-to-human connection and the value of really just connecting with people in person. It's the best. It's the thing I'll never miss.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7 or 8-figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. ECF Fuel Gauge, last topic we'll talk about in the forums was, got to give a big shout out to Patrick Ryan, who's our director of ops. And this fall, while I was taking a little time off, he and the team put together a really great idea and concept called the Fuel Gauge in the community. One of the hard parts about building community, moderating it well, is kind of helping to encourage and tactfully guide the give and take of members. And so this is a kind of a number, you know, from 0 to 1,000 or something, that does its best to quantify, this is always imperfect, but quantify the contribution you've made to the community in terms of helping other people, maybe hosting meetups online and offline. And so it's kind of fun and a fun way to gamify it. So anyway, if you're in the community, if you're in the forums, check that out, kind of see where you're sitting. And for all of those that have poured a lot into the community, thank you. And we'll definitely be using this as a way to hopefully, you know, reward, take extra special care of those that are adding a lot of value. So I don't know, did you see this come across, Bill?
I did. It just appeared in my profile. And I am concerned that I am not in the top 10.
We'll have to start getting some offline badges for podcast hosting and things like that. And that's one of the things too, that when you go through and do something like this, it's very imperfect and you have to iterate over time. So, but yeah, we'll have to look at that for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm suspect about this. Maybe we need some tweaks in this algorithm here, because all time I am number 26.
Ooh. Okay. We're gonna have to look at this.
I know. I am beating Mike Jackness, which is really all that matters to me.
Well, this is actually a really good point, because one thing that I grossly underestimated when we started building our internal review directory in the forums, and so this is like, it's reviews of software and service providers, was how difficult it is to be able to create a ranking algorithm. And you think like, oh, it's easy. Like, I'm just going to average things out and here's the rank. But you're like, no. You've got, for the review directory at least, you had, okay, well, how many reviews are there? When were they last left? Because reviews that are more recent, you want to rank more highly than ones in the past. How do you have a decay function? How do you weight different things? Like, how do you give credibility to more credible forum members? This very basic thing we went through, and it gave me a lot of respect for Google, as much as I like to poop on them sometimes. creating algorithms that set some kind of hierarchy is way more complex than you would guess at first looking at it.
I believe that. A lot of factors. And clearly you've gotten it wrong because I need to be right.
This is what I get for doing my homework and checking your ranking. So, or actually, Bill, maybe you were number 3 and we just manually pushed you down to 25 to get a reaction out of you here.
I believe that. Yeah. Well, I am 26 and Mike Jackness is 27. So at least you have something going on. A little bit right.
We'll be talking to Patrick as soon as we hop off, but in general, excited about it. Next thing on the list here, the crew over at Ecom CFO, Sam and Ethan, they released a report looking at, so they're you know, obviously like the name implies, they're CFOs for a number of meaningful sized e-commerce companies. And they put together a really great report about trends over the last year. You can check it out at ecomcforeports.com. But I had some interesting takeaways there. Bill, I've got a handful here. Do you, any that you want to highlight first or should I dive into these?
I'll let you go first.
Okay. I think we do want to caveat this with, this was not a massive sample size. I think it was maybe 25 plus or minus somewhere in there. I'm not exactly sure. So you do want to take this with a grain of salt. This isn't like you're, doing a US census of, California or anything. But the big thing that came through in the numbers was that larger e-commerce companies, those, 50 million and above are doing reasonably well. And companies in the one to 50 and especially 1 to 10 have had a rough year. If you look at revenue growth, under 50 million, it was about 11% average revenue growth. Over 50 million was 50% plus. Under 50 million, EBITDA is really not growing. It did not grow this year, at least. Over 50 million, they saw a significant increase in EBITDA. Under 50 million is showing pretty thin EBITDA margins. I think single digit, maybe I'm trying to remember exactly from the report, 3, 4%, 5% on average, which is pretty thin. Over 50% was showing double digits. And the one encouraging thing I saw was that gross margins were not really changed, over the last year. So you think about your supplying, your supply chains, things like that. Didn't seem to be the issue. It seemed to be much more fixed costs going up and driving expenses. So I think the increase in paid spend was like 15% bump of overall revenue, or a 15% increase in the amount of money spent toward paid ads. I don't know if that was controlled for revenue growth, but anyway, some of the bottom line, it's hard. This has been a hard year to be a smaller e-commerce company.
I mean, I think it's getting harder and harder to be a small e-commerce company. The returns to scale are more and more. I mean, I've heard the kind of the journey from 1 million to 10 million described as hell. It's just so hard. Like, it's easy to get to $1 million because, you're an entrepreneur, you find a niche market, you get those perfect customers, right? But to scale up out to broader niches, the broader market from 1 to 10 is hard. It's hard from an advertising customer acquisition point of view. It's also hard from an organizational design point of view. I mean, like that's the part of the journey where you have to start hiring people. That's the part of the journey where you have to become a manager. Maybe you got to build another layer of management. You got to start doing reporting, in a way because the whole business doesn't fit in your brain anymore. It's hard for any business, especially e-commerce businesses. Meanwhile, if you have scale, right, you're all bidding on the same impressions. If you have scale and capital, you can wait longer, right? You can wait for a 1-year LTV to pay back, right? Because you can absorb that J curve. You can pay for better talent. It's just, I've said this for years, it's easier to be bigger than smaller. In fact, that was one of the big insights, things that I learned from doing the Elements Brands e-commerce roll-up, is that we should have raised more money and bought bigger businesses because bigger businesses are way easier than smaller businesses.
Yeah. Well, you also have these assets that you acquired. You were able to build up and acquire at a time when buying attention was cheaper. You've got massive email lists, right? You have massive customer lists. You have larger social media followings. These things that you're able to go up and buy up the land when the land was cheaper. So I think that's a big part of it too. And if I had to bet, I would say you're going to see a reversion to the mean as some of those decay, right? Like your email list it's not something that's set in perpetuity. You have people, fall away. You have to build them back again at newer prices, at new kind of expensive advertising rates or attention rates. So I think we'll see a reversion to the mean, but yeah, it was definitely a difficult year. We should do an episode, Bill, on, this is something I actually want to do a deep dive on and a big blog post on about kind of what the new world of e-commerce looks like, because it is harder. I also am convinced that like any hard period, you're going to have a lot of difficulty that is going to probably take out a lot of players, but the people that remain on the back end will also be well positioned. Like, think about any real estate crash. You have a market where the real estate market's in the tank for, you know, for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and you lose 70-80% of the realtors. Well, the realtors that are left, the best time to be a realtor is at the bottom of a market. The best time to start a business is when things are hard, right? Or in a recession. So yeah, we should do a full episode on talking about some of the thoughts on this, because there's a lot here.
Oh, I think the question is it cyclical or is it directional? I mean, you seem to be operating under the assumption that it's cyclical. I'm not sure it is. And the easiest way to kind of frame this or make my argument is, how many small businesses do you see buying Super Bowl ads? How many small businesses did you see partaking in kind of legacy commerce, right? On the shelf at Walmart, running Super Bowl ads, you know, like, it's CPG, consumer products, has always been a scale game, always, right? Then e-commerce got invented and it was relatively small to start and it was relatively complicated and it was very different. So it took a while for, you know, big brands to kind of look at it. And similarly, it took a while to home grow its own big brands, right? A lot of people that got into e-commerce, you know, figured it all out and built 9-figure businesses, great businesses. But now you have, this channel has behemoths now, right? Both behemoths from the old world that have come over and also its own homegrown behemoths. And there are returns to scale in consumer products and always have been. And now there are scaled players. And I don't necessarily know, I don't see what would make it revert.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I think we'll, in the next couple of months, we'll do a deep dive on this, because I think you're right. This is good. The best episodes we do are one where you and I are, when both you and I are agreeing, like, TikTok's terrible. It's, you know, it's way more fun when you and I are coming at it from opposite sides, smashing each other with stuff and just head to head. So stay tuned for an episode on that. That sounds like a lot of fun. Also helps me think about it more critically too, which is always something I need. Last question here, or topic here, Bill, and this is completely off of, actually we got two more. Any beers drinking, you look at America, and obviously no surprise here, massive trend. A lot of the brewers, the distillers, the talk about scale, the big ones in America and even internationally, I think are kind of freaking out because people just aren't drinking as much, especially people under 25 or 30 are just, you know, they're just not drinking hard at anywhere near the rates they were when you and I were in college.
And they're not driving cars. They're not having sex. They're not doing any of the things that we did and our parents did when they were young.
Yeah. The sex and the drinking might be related. Those might be correlated.
Yeah, exactly.
So my question to you is, one, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, I think. But I'm curious how you approach alcohol. Like, you know, I'm 42. You're a couple of years younger than I am. But we're both like, you know, roughly plus or minus 40-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry to slap that label on you prematurely. How do you approach alcohol? Because, like, thoughts on that? Do you drink? Do you abstain? Like, how do you approach alcohol in your life?
I drink. I enjoy alcohol a lot. I mean, it's very fun. The hangovers are getting less and less fun as with every year that goes by. And that's the problem, is that I have to pay for it more and more and more. And so I'm definitely much more careful as far as the quantities that I drink and, you know, how late I stay up and all that. I'm 40, to your point. But I like alcohol a lot. I don't ever view myself as being one of those people who, like, goes dry and, like, doesn't do it anymore. Like, I like to make a cocktail. I like wine. You know, I like to have a beer while I watch football or sit on the beach or whatever. Like, that makes, those things make my life better, you know, to drink alcohol with friends. Like, I'm not interested in cutting that out. I do find myself having to moderate my drinking so I don't get crushed the next day by hangover.
Got it. Thanks. It's interesting. I would say the way I've approached it is, I don't know, 2-3 years ago, realized that, like, I'd get done with a day of work or I'd come in from doing something and I'd sit down and I would instinctively grab a beer out of the fridge. And what I realized was I love beer. I really love, like, a good cold beer. It's hard to beat. But a lot of it, probably 70-80% of what I was really wanting was something that was just cold and refreshing and delicious. And so I have shifted probably 80% of my drinks in that format to non-alcoholic drinks, either non-alcoholic beers or mocktails. A couple of shout outs. There's a company called Go Brewing that makes amazing NA beers and good IPAs. I've heard Sam Adams makes some really good NA stuff. There's a company.
Athletic Brewing makes good non-alcoholic beer too.
Yeah, Athletic Brewing makes good stuff. There's a company, my absolute favorite, Annie, and my absolute all-time new favorite mocktail, or even just drink at the end of the day, is something called Morning Vinga. And this is a shout out to Mike Kitma and his wife, Rachel. If you're in the forums, Mike sadly passed away, really unfortunately, about 6 months ago. And his wife is running the business. An incredible guy. I've never met her, but I'm sure she's just as wonderful. And that is what kind of turned me on to their product. And originally started buying it just to kind of support her, and we got it. And I mixed this stuff. It's like all organic, and it's made from honey and all these amazing like mints and leaves and things. And you pour about an ounce of it into just sparkling water or like LaCroix. You mix it up. It is the absolute best mocktail. I would say it is better than 90% of legitimate cocktails that I drink, and it's really good for you. So,
is it a vinegar?
It has like apple cider vinegar. It's got honey. It's got all of these organic, like different types of herbs. It's freaking delicious.
All right. I need to try some of this because I've been doing some drinking vinegars as well.
Yeah.
Natalie asked for these drinking vinegars from this brand Costarina for Christmas. And so I bought them. She asked for it. So I just bought it. And then I have drank like most of them. Same thing. Like, you know, like an ounce in like a Spindrift or like some sort of flavored fizzy water. Yeah. It tastes like a cocktail. And so you taste like you're having something special.
Yeah. Like we'll get one and we'll just rip through it. Like we'll just guzzle it. It's so good. We have zero self-control, but it's way better than having zero self-control with like Jack Daniels, right?
So. Oh yeah. 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 Another similar thing that I will do is I will buy Spindrift, which is like, that's like 10 calories. Like it's fizzy water with a little fruit juice in it.
Yeah.
And then I will put cocktail bitters in it. Like orange bitters, or you can buy flavored bitters, and it kind of makes it taste like a cocktail, even though it's just non-alcoholic.
Interesting. I'll have to try that too. To your point, I've definitely shifted the vast majority of my drinking to non-alcoholic, but I still very much am not a teetotaler. Like we had friends over this last week, definitely had a few beers with them. If it's Sunday and you're hanging out with friends watching football or something, it's hard to beat cracking a good beer. So the way my litmus test is an alcoholic drink here going to make this social experience more enjoyable? And as long as I'm not heading out with friends, you know, every other night during the week, you know, I try to have a reasonable take on it and still enjoy a drink. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. I just don't ever see myself cutting out alcohol. Like that is optimization gone too far. Right. Yeah. I mean, like I agree, like alcohol is a poison. It's not good for me. But like I do lots of other shit that's not good for me as well, that's less fun than drinking alcohol, right? So like drinking in moderation to enhance social experience with friends is something that I want in my life.
Yeah, no, agreed. Well, coming up this next month, we have actually, Bill, right in your neck of the woods, Charlotte meetup Thursday, February 27th from 5 to 7. Huge thank you to Tony and Sturgeon in Charlotte for hosting this and making it possible. I think it's going to be happening at Second Skin Audio. So if you are in the community, hit the events tab. You can find out more about that. We got ECF Live tickets going up for sale in early April. It's going to be in Bozeman this year, late September, which I'm super excited about.
I'm so pumped for this. Yeah, Bozeman is awesome.
Wait, was last time you were in Bozeman when we skied together at Big Sky?
At Big Sky, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm geeking out hard. I'm looking right now at the mountains out my office window, and it's going to be fun to host everyone here. I'm excited. And also putting the finishing touches on a new website and brand, which is going to be launching hopefully right before we sell tickets. That's been in the works for 9 months now, and excited to get that out there in the world. So that's what's coming up for myself. Bill, what do you got coming up this next month?
Just working hard. We're recording 4 podcast episodes a week. You know, I've got consulting clients. We're busting our butt at Natural Dog Company because we're coming into allergy season, which is our big high season. Dogs start itching and scratching, and they need supplements and they need fish oils and things like that to help them with it. So we start ramping as soon as the pollen comes out. So we got like 3 weeks to go.
Bill, I was on your website last night prepping for this. Is it true you have a dog wrinkle balm for dogs? And if so, who is buying wrinkle balm for their dogs?
100%. So like, I think you're interpreting it as like an anti-wrinkle bomb, that's not what it is. It's not to make your dog look more youthful.
Okay, that's what I was thinking this was. I thought this was like a Kim Kardashian balm you like rubbed on your dog's face.
No, it is for brachiocephalic dogs, which are like pugs or terriers that have the squished face, right? Like the wrinkly face, and they can get skin irritation inside the skin folds. So this helps to be antiseptic and soothe the irritation and keep them from getting dried out.
If
you've got a wrinkly dog, you're rubbing this into their skin folds.
Got it. You could have some fun with the copy on this, you realize, you know, on the page for this. Talking about how your dog is feeling insecure and society is judging it and this is the solution, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, but it's not anti-wrinkle. Like, it's not going to make those wrinkles go away, right?
That's I know. I realize that. But I'm just saying you can have a lot of fun with a joking angle from the copy.
We do spa day emails where, because we have shampoos and we have treats and we, the balms for foot rubs. So we do have fun. We have spa day emails. We even have, I don't know if you saw, Dolce & Gabbana came out with a cologne for dogs, which is like $100 for 2 ounces or something. And it's full of, artificial fragrance and poison. Like, it's obviously terrible. And we make a all natural essential oil spritz that we've sold for a long time as a spritz for dogs, which, helps keep their coat nice in between baths and stuff. And I said, you can either buy Dolce & Gabbana poison for $100, or you can buy our spritz for like $14.95, and it's all natural and much better for your dog. It achieves the same thing.
Oh man, your dog products are probably way better than the stuff I'm using on my head and deodorants. I just start using it and not telling anybody.
Probably. All of our stuff is human grade. You can use it. I mean, we were just at a trade show on Monday and like many people eating the dog supplements.
Do you use that for content? Like, I could see that'd be really good viral content, having people like gnawing on the bones, popping the vitamins.
We really should do that, like a taste test and like have the people try it. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's chia powder and, it's nothing that you wouldn't eat. It doesn't taste bad. It just tastes kind of like bready.
Well, Bill, before we put a bow on this one, give people, I've mentioned it at the top, but in your own words, because obviously you'll do a better job than I will, tell people about Acquisitions Anonymous if they're not listening, as well as kind of the consulting you do with folks.
Yeah. So if you're interested in buying and selling businesses, if you might want to sell your business, or you think you might want to buy one to do an add-on, there's a lot to learn about that topic, about buying and selling businesses. And I've done 8 or 9 M&A deals myself, my own businesses, plus advised on many others during my time in investment banking. And so myself and my 3 other co-hosts, Michael Girdley, Mills Snell, and Heather Anderson, all of whom have done multiple M&A deals. Heather is actually one of the highest volume SBA lenders in the country, which is pretty cool. She's been doing it for 25 years and actually maybe longer, and helped popularize the use of the SBA 7A program for change of control transactions for small business. So we publish twice a week, and each week we review a business that is for sale. We get the teaser for a business, and we might say the one we just recorded earlier today is an e-commerce business that sells indestructible kids' glasses. And they have the license from Blippi. If you know who Blippi is on YouTube, he makes kids' content and he wears glasses. So they have licensed Blippi, and they make Blippi-themed glasses among aviators and all kinds of other prescription glasses for kids. Really cool. So we broke down the deal, talk about what we like about it, what we don't like about it, how we would diligence it, what we think it might sell for, et cetera. So it's a really fun kind of talk show format where we talk about businesses that are for sale.
Yeah, it's super fun to listen to. And I love the different perspectives that you all come with, different angles. And you all are very experienced in the world with your own, just kind of slight take on or unique takes on things. So it's super fun to listen to. And then the consulting side, who could be potentially a good fit on that end?
Yeah. So I sort of do this on the side, but I had so many people wanting me to help them that I kind of, spun this up and formalized it a little bit. So I have kind of up to 4 clients. At the moment I'm full, but which is great because people don't usually leave, but I have the wait list is relatively short. So you can get on the wait list. And what I'll do is kind of meet with you every week. We talk about optimizing your financial stack to make sure that you're using the right credit cards, the right bank accounts, et cetera. But we also do a lot of cash flow forecasting, make sure that people don't need to get in a pinch where they need to take an MCA loan, make sure they're budgeting appropriately, make sure they're ordering inventory appropriately, make sure they're spending on ads appropriately, and kind of improve the profitability of their business. I also help with management stuff. How do I set up my organization? Hey, this employee's giving me trouble. Hey, this person's really high potential. How do I make sure they grow? All kinds of things like that. Kind of learn from my, nearly 15 years of experience now operating e-commerce businesses, running manufacturing and 3PL and marketing teams and buying Facebook ads and running on Amazon, all the stuff that I've done. So if that sounds cool to you, if you think you might need sort of like a board member / consigliere who you can run your hard problems past, you can learn more about doing that with me at BillDA.com/consulting.
Awesome. Well, Bill, always fun. Looking forward to doing this on the regular. Yeah, man. Hope you have a good rest of the month. And we're going to have to get some skiing at some point. It's been 7-8 years since we got out there. So hopefully
me and Kelsey are organizing a ski-com trip 1 year from now. So early 2026.
Nice. All right.
So you and everybody listening is on the invite list.
I may crash that or try to, even if I get invited. So
thanks for having me. I'm enjoying my new position as co-host of the E-commerce School podcast. This is great.
I know. This is man, one episode in and the coup is in its early stages. So
that's right. That's right. All right. See everybody next time.
Thanks, man. If you're an entrepreneur who wants to connect with other experienced owners who are working to build a financially vibrant business alongside a rich, meaningful life, head on over to ecommercefuel.com to learn more and connect with 1,000 entrepreneurs just like you. Work hard, adventure often, and forge what matters. Look forward to seeing you again next Friday.